Mike, I just put some on.
It should be, yeah. You have to turn it on. Yeah.
Mike, I just like to ask what the sound of many waters brings, that angel.
Okay, the angel of the sound of the many waters, the voice of the Lord is like the sound of many waters in Revelation 1. And when you engage the sound of the sound of many waters, you are stepping into the frequency of his voice, which will call you into the deeper things of God. So deep calls to deep at the sound of his waterfall, and the sound of many waters is like the waterfall of his presence, which will, as you engage it, will begin to unravel and unveil the deeper things. Deep calls to deep. So he's calling to your spirit deep to come back into the fullness of who you are, really. But he can, that revelation can actually come in many different ways. But it's essentially, it's his voice. So the angel represents the frequency of his voice. And some people go in there and they feel like it's a waterfall on top of them. Some people just engage and feel the sense of his voice speaking to them. But it is a call. Deeper, deep calls to deep. And that's really, I think, what the heart of that angel is about. Calling us deeper into our destiny, into our identity, and into him. So, yeah. Okay. Anyone else got any questions? Yeah. Just want to come and...
What is Sean? Could you address...
Yeah, I can deal with the everlasting doors. In context, we are a gateway of heaven, and therefore heaven can flow through us. But if we're going to deal with the atmosphere, then we have to have what comes from above through that atmosphere. And the everlasting doors are in the first creation. It was where the glory of God poured out onto the earth. And the river of life was, in a sense, the glory of God in that way, poured out onto the earth. And the residue of what there is left of that is what we call ley lines. Yeah, ley lines. Ley lines are the grid system around the earth, which is a representative of all those gates would open. So when there are intersection of ley lines, you find there are places of power. Ley lines, yeah. So essentially... there are churches that have been built on ley lines because they recognize they were places of power. And there are a lot of New Agey people who do all sorts of stuff on ley lines because most of the church have just rejected it as something which we shouldn't touch. But actually, it's the residue of the everlasting doors. When we begin to pour out, see the glory of God poured out, then those everlasting doors will be opened and we'll see, again, a restoration of the glory of God on the earth. But Psalm 24 is obviously where it comes from. You know, be lifted up, O you heads, you know, as gates. So you need to be lifted up in authority as a head into heaven, into the realms where you're seated with Christ in heavenly places. Then you have access to see the everlasting doors lifted up. And then things can come through that. So it says, so the glory of, you know, so the Lord, the glory will come through the everlasting door. You know, who is the King of Glory? So the King of Glory will come in. So, but it's not coming in through us, because that's different. It's coming in through the atmosphere. So at the moment, you could open everlasting doors and it might not come through, or it'd take a long time to come through, like Daniel prayed, and the atmosphere was resisting what was coming out of heaven. So we have to clear the atmosphere to engage those everlasting doors correctly. And there are kings that sit in those everlasting doors, which are the Ites nations, which in our generational lines will hinder us from having the authority of those doors. Because whoever sits in the gate or in the door affects what comes through. Right. So if you've not dealt with the kings in your life, then the everlasting doors, you can't operate because you're not in headship and as a gate. So, yeah, there's a lot more that we'll begin to engage, I think, with those, that whole thing, once we've learned to deal with other things. But it's, in principle... something which has been open, closed, and now they're trying to stop it being opened again. Sometimes they are, you know, you will have an everlasting door over your own life.
Would that be the door like Jacob's ladder?
No, because that's an open heaven that we go in through. This is the other way. Okay. This comes out of. So we have to go into so it can come out of. But I would say spend most of your time focused on opening your first love gate and getting a flow of heaven through you as a gateway of heaven, because that's what you can impact much more now. Because if we haven't dealt with the atmosphere, you aren't going to deal with everlasting doors. So it will happen, and you know, some people probably engage in them, so dealt with all the kings, do whatever's blocking them. But I don't think we're going to see that yet. But I do believe we will once we're in a place to be able to administrate it.
You had on your screen your pictures of, you know, the thrones where you had, you said that it was our throne above the mountains.
Yes.
And when God is dealing with me to surrender and lay down everything, he also said that whoever was reigning on that, I don't know if it was the same throne, but whoever was on the throne of my life was the one that was in control. And then he was like, I don't want you there. You're laying down your life. You're surrendering everything. Vacate that and let me reign and be seated on that throne. Is that the same throne in the picture?
No.
Oh, okay.
The throne in the picture, which I think you're referring to as that throne.
No, the other picture.
Yeah,
there it is.
That one.
There.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
That's your position in the heavens.
Oh, okay.
So you only get access to that position in the heavens fully when he's on the throne in your spirit. So it's the seat of rest and government within you. Yeah. So when you open your first love gate and you invite God to come in, the Father, you need to invite to sit on the throne of your life so you're not in charge. Absolutely what you said.
Okay.
So you're not ruling. You abdicate so he can rule in you. But then if you're in him and he's on your throne, in him you have access to this throne and other thrones in realms because you're seated with Christ in heavenly places. But it's what goes on inside here and in your life is surrender, abdication. I don't want to be in control of my own life anymore. So, and once you've done that in your spirit, then you have the same another throne in your soul, in the garden of your heart, that you also have to surrender. Because once your spirit is surrendered, then you have to get this soul thing dealt with. So my soul surrenders.
Can you say that again? That whole sentence, I missed the first part.
Okay.
But right after the throne, you said also in your garden
of your heart. Yeah. Well, in your spirit, you have the seat of rest and government.
Right.
And that is where we yield to the Lordship of God, the Father, to be enthroned in us. But in our soul, there's also where we have the right, free will, and every day in the garden, I have a throne in the garden, which again, I invite him to come and be seated on. So I'm not, my soul isn't in charge, my spirit isn't in charge, he's in charge of everything. You know, and in a sense, it's just about the process of soul and spirit being in total agreement with him, and in that process of going through the dark cloud and all the stuff you do in your soul is to get you to the point of total surrender. And it's not an easy thing because the soul has the right to free will. I just don't want it.
Right.
You know, I know what free will does when I make the choice of free will. Most of it's not good. You know, so I'd rather surrender my free will to his. So I do that every day. You know, I have the authority to be and I surrender it so I'm only what he says. So, you know, it's just there. But whatever you do in you, and they recognize that God's on the throne in you, heaven recognizes your authority. The sort of the angelic realm comes around us and the canopy surrounds us when we actually, they recognize the throne of God in us. And then heaven recognizes our position of lordship. So you can have a position of lordship and you can be in that position. But the authority that you actually operate in will be proportional to the level of holiness that you're living. So if you're operating out of the soul, then the authority will be limited. Because if you operated in power with the power of the soul, you could damage things, and people particularly. I mean, if you can imagine having the power that everything you said came about instantly, how many people might have died as a result of you cursing them? Particularly when you're driving, they cut you up or something. You know, not that I would say anything like that, of course, but I'm sure some people might do here. Yeah, but you have to be careful because you don't want to use your words because in any way, the wrong way. So it's just being in a sense where you're yielded. You know, and it's that yieldedness which gives us authority.
You know? That's when your spirit is on the outside?
Well, yeah, because what you're doing is your spirit is your soul allows your spirit to encompass it and through your body to create that atmosphere around you, which is the kingdom, rivers of living water, fragrance, light, radiating frequency of love. So people come close enough to you and they experience God's presence. So rivers of living water flowing through you.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, come
on. I'm just speak. Use your mic.
Yeah, just so everyone can hear. Yeah.
All right.
I know we as people, we have two strands of just natural DNA from our mothers and father.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, the third strand of light, which comes from God.
Yes, our spirit. Yeah.
Yes. And I was wondering, what was Adam's three strands of DNA? I know he had God's strand, but what was his other two?
They were pure, basically. So they were, in a sense, he was created man, so he had DNA, but it was not polluted in any way. So it fully reflected the image that he was created in, body, soul, and spirit, in the image of God. Because you know, in Genesis 1, he created man in his image, in his likeness he created him. So that would be a three-stranded being, and then all of it was not yet perfected. Because God doesn't want us to stay a three-stranded being. He wants us to become a 12-stranded being, which is actually carrying, and each of those 12 strands actually, oh no, I'm not going to go there. Anyway, but each of those, because we take on the 9 strands of God's DNA. So that's when the dance floor is DNA comes around us and the light of our DNA then begins to take on the image. So we're baptized into him. We're surrounded. So we're surrounded with the armor of light and the armor of righteousness and the armor of God. And we're surrounded with the righteousness, peace and joy of the Holy Spirit and the way, truth and the life. And the different aspects of the fruit of the Spirit and all those things are his characteristics because he's called us to be conformed to his image. And so it's the conformation to his image, which is the process which would have brought the 9 fire stones on Satan's body, or the stones that reflected the fire stones in the garden of God, to bring us into the ascension of that image. So we would have been conformed, because Adam was sinless but not perfected, because it was predestined that we would all be conformed to his image. And that predestined was before we came into this world. So in a sense, there should have been a process, and we are now can embrace that process to take on the 9 strands and the 9 colors of that DNA and then come into the fullness of government, which is 12. Yeah. So you know, 3 of ours and 9 of theirs, and so we come into fullness of government. And that will be the full reflection of his image. So, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah.
That has to do with the 7, right?
Okay, yeah. The angel of the church, or angel of the house, depending which way you look at it. In the establishment of the Kahal, which was the house, the community of God, you had to have a 3 bent baked in and a 7, and the angel of the house was the connection or the agreement point between the 3 and the 7. We always need agreement, and that was the point of agreement. So in a sense, they were called the angel of the house because they carry the apostolic vision of the blueprint that God had released, and then they enabled the 7 to function according to that. It's not that they're not above the 7, it's an equal place. All the 7 have to function together in unity, but they have a role within the 7. And actually, in the early church, they had lots of different roles. So when you look at, they had 3 pastoral roles. They had a prophetic role. They had a teaching role. They had an evangelistic role. And they all had different names in Hebrew. You know, I mean, you know, I don't go into the Hebrew names because it gets people confused trying to say them. Well, actually, I can't say them very easily, so I don't talk about them. but they all had names, you know. I think the angel of the house was called the Shalat Tizbor. You know, I remember that one. But it's just then when in Revelation it talks, send the letter to the angel of the church. It wasn't the church. The angel was sent by the angel to the church. So it wasn't taking an angel to an angel. It was an angel to the person who would then bring the revelation to the church of what the angel was saying and the message to bring the environment of the church in alignment with what God was saying. It's a really important role. And if you don't have it, you can tend to find there can be a disconnect between the three and the seven, or conflict even sometimes. And they help communication and understanding, and they see things from an apostolic position so that then whatever we do in the environment carries the blueprint within it. That's how it works with us.
So is the angel of the house part of the seven?
Yeah, it's one of the seven. Okay. Yeah. That was the original 10, because 10 is a governmental thing for the house, whereas the kingdom is 12.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to address the DNA, the cell memory, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
Is that how the sins of the father are on to the third and fourth generation? Is that through cell memory? Because you talked about alcoholism, and you talked about how that is... opens the door for them.
Okay. Their cell memory is where trauma is stored within the record of the cells, and therefore your mind and your body can have a memory, and that trauma continues to bring on going problems. When you sin, or when someone sins and they continually sin, it can create patterns of iniquity in them, and there can be epigenetic factors that become triggers. So actually, the DNA, it's not the, you know, I mean, I'd have to go into a science lesson to explain the whole thing. But in reality, your DNA obviously has the strands and everything else. And there are different, the four different codons that make up the DNA. But on there is what's called methylated. They get methylated. And that methylation actually creates what's called an epigenetic factor. And that epigenetic factor can happen through trauma or continued repetition. And actually that then becomes something which is ingrained in the DNA. So we have epigenetic factors for certain sickness as predispositions within our DNA for, like, let's say, diabetes. And if you look after your body and you don't abuse it and you don't necessarily create the environment for that diabetes ever to trigger. So it's there, but it's never triggered by the environment. These factors, you could have an alcoholic sort of epigenetic factor, and if the environment never triggered it, it may never come out. But when the environment does trigger it, people who never used alcohol before become alcoholics just like that, because all of a sudden that triggers to cover up the trauma that they've experienced. So whatever trigger it is will essentially be triggering that factor within the DNA. So, but also within the sequences of our DNA, we have 2-3% of our DNA, which is actually, you know, how we look, our parental DNA, which carries, a bit of our grandparents and a bit of a grand, all that stuff. And that essentially creates us. So when the egg and the sperm come together, there's this sort of wrestling that takes place, of what you're going to look like. You're going to carry more of your father, you're going to carry more of your mother. And some girls look more like their father than their mother, because there's that sort of thing that goes on to bring what we look like. But there's most of our DNA, the sort of other 97%, used to be called junk DNA by scientists because they didn't know what went in there. But the Russians, when they were looking at the human genome, the Western scientists looked more about how they could splice the human genome and understand what was in the human genome. But actually, the Russians found that it was more like a language. It was syntax and grammar. They couldn't sort of necessarily understand what it said, but they realized there were things that were seen to be encoded within there. And they actually discovered if you used frequencies of sound on modulated laser beams, then you could actually resequence the DNA because it responded to certain sound and frequency. So there are also sequences within our DNA which are actually non-human seed. So you have the seed of Cain, because in Genesis 3, Jesus the Father said, or God said to them, you have the seed of the woman who was going to bring forth the Messiah Christ. You also have the seed of Satan, seed of serpent, serpent seed. And that actually was seed in a person that actually then was sown into things. Now you get to sort of Noah, it all gets wiped out, but Noah was the only one in righteous in all his generations, so he was pure. The rest of his family wasn't. So some of his family carried seed, which is why the giants were after the flood as well as before the flood, because it says in Genesis 6 they were hereafter as well as before. That's why. It was genetic, passing on. But within our DNA, those factors can be, as you say, iniquity is what's passed on as the sin of the fathers. It's a bent towards particular behaviours. And when you have that bent, it's so hard not to do that. You know, we have a game we play, which is called bowls. And it's like it's played on a grass lawn or sometimes on indoors. And it's like these wooden or sort of things. And inside them, there are weights. And when you roll it, it's a bias, and it always turns eventually to the side the bias is in. And you can do backhand or forehand, and it'll turn the other way, just on the way you put the bias. Now, you can stop it going curved by throwing it really hard, because sometimes there's a lot of things in the way. That's why I like that bit. And you throw it really hard and smash them all out of the way. But it takes a lot of effort. And most of our life is spent with that effort trying to stay straight, when this iniquity, which is a bent towards a particular behaviour because of the generational thing it's sown into us, draws us off. So in Isaiah 6, the coal from the altar removed the iniquity. So the fire of God can remove that iniquity through the, and we can do that through communion and everything else. But there are a lot of sort of factors in that. Genetic, epigenetic, iniquitous, bloodline, seed line stuff.
So it's actually purification of the DNA
itself. Yeah. So this purification of DNA, purification of the groups attached to it, the triggers on that DNA, and purification, you know, of the things in our life. And the physical things, you know, there can be trauma actually that still affects our body. And people can have something that happens to them traumatically, and they have an injury that even after it should have healed, the body still remembers it, and they still have a memory which still affects them afterwards. You know, and that, you can speak to that trauma and release the trauma from that cells or from that area of the body, and people get healed. You know, there's a lot of ministers out there that do that. Yeah.
Wow. Hi.
Okay.
My dad passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
And my mom says he comes to visit her. And I've told her that I believed it was a familiar spirit.
Yeah.
But after being here, listening to the cloud of witnesses,
yeah,
I'm feeling really bad.
Okay.
Because I'm wondering,
yeah,
if it really was my dad's cloud of witnesses.
Yeah, sure. If he was a believer and he's in the cloud of witnesses, then yes. The cloud was, I mean, you know, I've visited a number of people who've died simply because God gave me a mandate to bring comfort to some of those who are left behind. Now, I know people would say, well, you're talking to the dead and necromancy and all that stuff. They're not. They're living. They're spirits you're talking to, not dead bodies. And I brought a comfort. I mean, I've visited a number. When I'm mandated, I don't just go and do it. I have to have a mandate to do it. So, yes, they can. I mean, you know, there was a lady in Kansas that we was part of the Engaging God program. Several people here knew her. She died, you know, and, you know, and it was a shock, you know. And, you know, I felt at the time, you know, well, is this something right about this? It didn't feel right. But anyway, I decided, well, I'm going to go and ask her. And actually, you know, she didn't want to come back. That's for sure. But what she said was, I'm not left. You know, I am still part of the cloud of witnesses. I am supporting what you do, but I have a role there which is actually more than what I could do on the earth. Now, that didn't mean God took her. You know, there were factors. You know, and we can't blame God. We blame the enemy, because death comes through sin, and sin is from the enemy. So, yeah, definitely you can see them. They can come. They can also be familiar spirits, you know, or familial spirits, if it's not an unbeliever. If it's an unbeliever, then no, their spirit won't come back. But something that was in them can come and misrepresent that, which is why all the seances and all that sort of stuff, essentially they're not contacting dead people. They're contacting the demons that were in people, and they have memory of what went on generationally, if it's a generational line. The key thing is it should not produce fear.
Yeah, she was never afraid.
No, well, that's the key. If it was something from the dark side, there would have been something in her spirit would have been afraid. It would have produced a negative reaction. So when the clairvoyances come, it always produces peace. It doesn't bring fear.
Well, I'm going to correct myself with her.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just, well, we're all on a journey, and we don't know. And when we do know, then we know more.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some amazing encounters in that realm. I mean, one of the most incredible things was when I visited my grandchildren who died. I had three grandchildren who died. Well, they were miscarried. And, you know, and this was one really early days in my encounters in heaven. And I was walking with Jesus in heaven, and he took me to this place. It isn't in heaven. It's attached to heaven. It's a dimensional place where all those who died through abortions, through miscarriages, are being trained into their eternal destiny. They don't get their earthly destiny because they died. But they're being trained. And I went to sit there, met two of my grandchildren, and they don't grow at the same age as they do on earth. So this was probably a few years, but they were more like young children, 7 or 8, something like that. I knew their names. They communicated. They called me granddad. And I thought, well, what was that about? I mean, it was very emotional. I mean, I was in tears. I mean, just, you know. And I knew their heavenly names, and they knew their characters. I mean, it's wonderful. And then I talked to my wife, and she said, oh, our daughter, they're trying to say that she's got postnatal depression. So, and she never dealt with either of those situations, because the first one, she got pregnant the next month, so she never dealt with it. The second one, she actually had twins, so one of the twins actually miscarried and the other one carried on, so she carried on a pregnancy. But you have to deal with things, you know. And so she was obviously weighed down, and so I said, look, I spoke to her and said, look, you might think this is weird, but I met them, they have names, they're growing, they're maturing actually, and what I encourage you to do is name them yourself and then say goodbye. And she did that, her and her husband, they did that, and actually the whole thing lifted off. You know, and actually my eldest daughter had a miscarriage. Now some people say, oh, that must run in your family, you need to do something in the courts. I asked God about it, and he didn't say to do that. You know, sometimes God knows more than we do. You know, and you know, but always he knows more than we do. And so you know, I don't ask certain things because actually I don't need to know. But you know, this was earlier on in the year, last year, and she lost one, and I never sensed there was, you know, she said she was pregnant, and you know, I can tell things, and I just, you know, I didn't say anything, Nick, but I just knew that this wasn't going to go to term. And you know, it was quite early on she lost it, and again I went into heaven, and it was totally different this time. There was this child was just full of like enthusiasm and identity, and I mean, it was an amazing thing. Now, when I engaged this, we had a prophetic word or a vision from heaven that a friend of ours was stepped into heaven while he was with us and actually said he saw all these children watching and observing what we were doing. There, the cloud of witnesses, which are children that are coming to maturity, are going to be released to the children of the Samuels who are being called right now as children, because they're going to be released to them, because it's not just going to be adults who are involved in the Joshua generation or the next generation. There's children. God is calling children. He's going to empower them, and they're going to have their own cloud of witnesses who have been matured in heaven to be able to come and embrace. So, yeah, there we go. Anyway, yeah.
I have two questions. The first one is, if you have like a portals, open gates, whatever you call it in your place, what kind of things do you need to be watched for?
Yeah, okay, that's a really good question.
And then the second question is the CERN, the particle accelerator.
Yeah.
What does that do with the spiritual realm?
Oh, right, okay. Yes, there are portals. Portals are neutral. You know, they're just portals. They're a gateway. It's what comes through them that you have to be careful of, or what you do to go through them. So we have an open heaven over our meetings. So we're working on it. Our bench is 7. They maintain an open heaven when we meet. But they're not in a place, and we're not in a place to maintain that all the time. But we do when we meet. We have a portal on the top of our stairs in the building. When we've had several sort of moves of God revival type things. One went on for months. And every time people walked up the top of the stairs, if they were any way spiritually sensitive, they just got hit. Because this portal was open. I mean, it's a powerful thing. And that we've had fragrances coming through it. We had smoke came through it. And actually, people smelled smoke. We were looking around the building to see if there was a fire. It was that real. And we had sulfur smells. And they're all good things. They weren't bad things. But they related to things that God was going to do. Now, when we had those meetings closed, actually, God told me to assign sentinel angels to stop that gate being opened. Now, that's because there's potential for that ancient portal for things to come through that shouldn't be. Now, when there was a revival setting going on, God was things, but he gave us, because we didn't even know what it was. We just sensed, hey, there's stuff going on. One guy came and says, there's a portal here. And it's just like, he was just like, bang, just couldn't stand up. Every time he walked in, he says, is there any other way I can come in through this building? Because I keep falling over, before he even got into the meeting. But the portals are something you have to be aware of. When I was in Phoenix, they've got a big mountain. Well, not big mountain, but it's a mountain. Is it Mount Graham down there?
Yes.
Yeah. And over that, there's a portal, and there are those who are trying to open that portal to get things to come through that portal that we wouldn't want. So they've got a really big angel down there that's assigned to stop that gate being opened. Now, when we come to maturity, we will open that gate. And we will get the right things through, and we will be able to go through into some of the things that are mysteries hidden in the darkness that we need to bring out of that portal into this realm. But so you have to be careful with those things to ensure that you guard them or assign angels to guard them. There was this whole thing last year about the Western Gate in November, Jason Westerfield and all the stuff around that. Early in November, I was engaging God with him in the morning. I was in heaven. I was talking to him. And he basically said, you need to send angels to guard the West Gate because people are planning for an interdimensional incursion through that gate.
Yes.
So assign angels. So I just did. How do you do that? Well, I assign angels to the West Gate. That was it. That's what you do. Tell angels, go to the West Gate. Guard the gate. Make sure no one opens it. And then all this thing blew up with, this invitation to try and get things to come through that West Gate. But now we've got people in position to ensure these things don't happen. Because we now have the authority and the do it. That Western Gate was opened twice before, to my knowledge. One in 1917 by Aleister Crowley, who was English occultist, and he used a Babylonian incantation to open that gate, and through it came through some beings called Lam. And when you look at the drawings of them, they look just like the Greys. Now, he shut that gate really quickly because even he was frightened, and it got shut. So there was a limited incursion, but it has had an ongoing effect. In 1947, interesting, this is towards the end of the First World War and after the Second World War, L. Ron Hubbard, who was the founder of Scientology, who those in LA know a lot about, and the founder of Dianetics, he and Jack Parsons, who was a rocket scientist, used another incantation to open a gate, and they invited things to come through. And that's since then we've had a lot of abductions and Roswell-type incidents. So, it's serious stuff. We're not talking about aliens from other planets. We're talking about interdimensional beings that fell with Satan, who traded with those dimensions with the stuff that he traded with the third of the angels. There was more that fell and were polluted than just the angelic realm. So there's a lot of stuff out there, but don't get freaked out by it. It's just like we rule. So make sure we're guarding, protecting, and doing what we're called to do is to establish the kingdom in that way. So,
is that connected with CERN?
The CERN question, I think, I don't personally, I know there's a lot of conspiracy stuff. Oh, they're going to create a black hole. They're not, because we're going to get to finish the job. Yes. The planet's not going to fall apart. There's no world war that wrecks everything. There are things that CERN is doing to try and engage particles and understand the nature of quantum physics and stuff. I find it really interesting because they're discovering things that just reaffirm things I already know. You know, I wish I'd written a book on quantum physics. I could have done, but it wasn't my role. But Phil Mason did, and he wrote one called Quantum Glory, which is a fantastic book. If you want to understand how quantum physics relates to the spiritual realm, Quantum Glory is the book to get. Phil Mason is an Australian. They do a lot of work in engaging New Age things, and they take true spirituality in and demonstrate the true power of God in those places. So the CERN thing, I'm not personally worried about that whatsoever, because I know they're not going to destroy the planet, because we're going to get the job done. So you know, people, there's all sorts of conspiracy stuff out there. You know, I'm not really a conspiracy theorist type person. Yeah, and people are very gullible out there. You know, don't believe everything you read on the internet, particularly Facebook. You know, you really, really just take it with a pinch of salt. I don't know how many times, like, to the same post, which has been going around, that Harvard scientists have found within human DNA a message from Jesus. And it's just a hoax. Yes. And Christians, they're so gullible, wanting to believe something like that, that they then post it. I mean, I just sort of say, I'm sorry, it's a hoax. Go back to the original source. See the website that originally published it. It's a hoax. And people just take hold of a whole load of stuff like that. There is an element of truth in some things, you know, but don't just go and swallow it and believe everything you read. You know, if you're concerned, take it back to God. You know, and if anything produces fear, you know what the source is. Yeah. Certainly got God. You know, so a lot of things like that. You know, I have no fear of science or what they're doing, because I know that we rule, basically. And everything science does, just, they never invented anything. They just discovered what God had already done, which is really great. They affirm God all the time. You know, and quantum physics, you know, is a fascinating thing. The problem that we have is that we didn't give quantum physicists a worldview that they'd actually accept the supernatural, so they looked to the East. So they came up with a more pantheistic or cosmic consciousness view rather than a personal God. But a lot of truth is in what they've written. They've just drawn the wrong conclusion. So, you know, I chew the grapes and spit out the pips in a lot of stuff. If you're not capable of doing that, just don't go there. You know, just keep talking to God, you know.
First of all, I'd just like to give honor to you, Mike, just to say thank you for your being consistent and given to the body of Christ. Just say thank you. Next question was about the frequency and resonance and stuff like that. I'm not really a scientific type of person. I stay away from science with personal opinion. I was wanting to know, like, because you said sound and light can change the frequency in our DNA or something of that nature.
Yeah.
And you said also music can change the DNA also. Was that it?
Well, there are certain frequencies and tones and binaural tones and whole tones. And there's a lot of stuff out there, which, you know, I know a bit about it. I'm not a musician. But when I went into heaven, God did tell me about it. So he told me to uncover what was going on with resonance and frequency and harmony and all those things. So I thought, well, okay, I'll Google it. And I found a whole load of New Age junk, basically, which you will when you find most of this stuff. But it doesn't mean there isn't truth behind it.
Right.
So in a sense, resonance is really where two things vibrate. And when they get close enough, the one that's the strongest vibration causes the other one to actually vibrate things. You do it with guitar strings. You put two guitars, you pluck one, and the other one plucks. And you can do it. I mean, Ray Hughes, who's a great guy on worship and stuff, he's done there's a YouTube video called Symphony of Heaven. And he actually demonstrates that on the video by actually sort of singing a note, and it puts the speaker next to the guitar, and the guitar plays the note just from his voice.
Wow.
So I look at it like I want to come close enough to God to resonate with the frequency that he carries, that then I would come into agreement. So whenever I'm in the realm of heaven, which is creative light. And, you know, I've talked about it before. God is light. He is the purest frequency of light and the speed of light that there is. And in eternity, he demonstrates pure creative light. He has released creative light into different realms of heaven, into the eternity realm of heaven, into perfection, into heaven of heavens into heaven, and down through kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God. So there are different frequencies of, or speeds of light in that creative light, which means in those realms there are different things you engage with and you come into alignment with. So the more my spirit spends time in creative light, the more it begins to take on the image of the light which is vibrating there, in a sense, because it's all electromagnetic energy. Everything is vibration. Einstein said everything is vibration. And it is, in one sense, because his voice, which is the vibration of the waves of his voice, is still in the fabric of everything that exists. That's why it holds together. So as little strings of energy, which is the voice of his power, is string theory is true, because God told me about it before I ever knew about it from this realm, that actually his voice is still vibrating in the frequency of everything. So you can connect with that voice. When you're in heaven and you connect with it, what I found is my spirit then carries that frequency, and because it's connected to my soul, quantumly entangled, my soul starts to align with that frequency and I change. So, and the different levels bring different levels of change, and each level requires surrender and submissance in one sense into that realm. I yield and I go into those realms. You know, you can't force your way in. You know, so there is a lot to do with it. Harmony, there are frequencies that we can use. I mean, the music I was playing earlier was written by one of the guys who was in our band, and he is on our Harmony Mountain, and they've got revelation of certain sounds and frequencies. And so that piece of music called Restoration, and he's produced it with, tuned his guitar to a particular frequency, which is for restoration. Because on the solfeggio scale of different musical frequencies, certain frequencies actually produce certain things. So 528 frequency is a healing frequency. Now, you know, we've retuned our instruments from what I think is A, which is tuned in an orchestra tuning, which was 440, and we've retuned to, I think, for 432. When we did that, and no one, the musicians didn't say anything, I mean, I just sensed it immediately. It was just like, whoa, this is different. You know, and there's a lot to that, which, you know, if you're not interested in science, then probably go over your head. But the main thing is, get close enough to God to be like him. Because that's a simple way to put it. For non-scientists.
So yeah. My question is about how to overshadow your family to bring them into this.
Okay. Well, everything you do must be in that way. You have to carry it in your heart. And it's not like, oh, well, I'm just going to put my family in heart and be blasé about it. You have to cultivate the desire for God's destiny for each of your family member rather than what you want for them. You know, you can't overshadow them and try and get them to be what you want. What you're doing is you're actually carrying them in your heart, and whenever you step in the realm of heaven, they go with you because you carry them in your heart. And so when you go there, it opens them up to God's presence because they're in you. Because you carry them there. But you have to cultivate that. It's not just something you can just say. You really have to cultivate it. You know, if I ever did the thing on framing, then you'd see how to do that. But also, when you have a sphere of government and you're extending your spirit out, then you can overshadow that your family with your spirit, because it's a sphere of government and it's an increasing sphere that your spirit goes around, extending your boundaries. You know, stuff I was talking about the other night. You can extend the boundaries of your spirit, because it's rivers of living water going out, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth. Any spheres you can come around. So, like for this room this morning, and there's a great atmosphere here, you know, all you've been engaging with the angels and doing all this stuff. You know, I didn't leave it to chance that we might have a good atmosphere. It was like I overshadowed this room that we were going to be in and this place with my spirit. And then I spoke truth into it. I called for the angels to come engage. I called for various things, and I began to order and bring government because I have a mandate for that here to be able to do that. And therefore, you do that with your family. So when I do that, then I become sensitive to what's going on in my family sphere. And then I can begin to speak into it, send angels into it, do things in that sphere because I'm sensitive to what's going on. When you carry people in your heart, you have authority towards them. Now, you don't have authority to overpower free will, because they have a choice. But what you do have the power to do is to create an environment that would help them make the right choice. So there's things you can do. If you're looking at family members and you want to see them come into salvation, release forgiveness to them. So forgive their sin. Now you say, well, you can't do that. Only God can do that. Well, read John. He said we can forgive sin. Now, it didn't mean we could forgive sin as in for salvation, but what causes darkness and the enemy to be able to veil their eyes so they can't see the truth? Sin. So when they go to sleep at night, release forgiveness over them and invite the angels and the Holy Spirit to work in them while they're asleep, because they can't sin while they're asleep till they get up the next morning. And if you do that consistently, you will find that they will be drawn more and more to salvation. But you have to be consistent, because it takes time to do it. Also, when you're engaging in that, you can engage with those children's angels or people's angels, because they are appointed to them because they are heirs of salvation. And God wants no one to perish. He doesn't just appoint angels to those who become believers, and they only get them when they're believers. They get angels appointed. That's why children recognize angels. Sometimes when you think they're talking to their imaginary friends, they're not. They're talking to the angels that God's assigned them. And we've taught our grandchildren to identify their angels at a really early age. I wish I'd knew that when my children were growing up, but I didn't. You know, so you can assign, you can talk to their angels and encourage their angels and give them a mandate to create environments around them for safety and security, but also for salvation experiences. Particularly, most Christians become Christians after a number of contacts with other Christians. Usually 5 or 6 seeds are sown. So you can call their angels to go out and make the connection so they'll come across those seed sowers to be able to then see that build up in their life. So you can be involved quite a lot in some of those things.
One more.
Okay. Just one, last one.
Okay, so since you asked that, I was just wondering if when something gets transformed in our DNA, can that affect all of our family, like our nieces, aunts, uncles that are on earth?
Okay. When you deal with something in your DNA and you have that factor removed, say it's an epigenetic factor, and it could be for, let's say, alcoholism, because we've used that one before. If you deal with it in your DNA and then it cannot be passed on to your children, although they're already born, so if you have any new children, you can't pass it on. Those that have already been born, you then have the power, because they haven't already engaged in it, then that power is broken. It all automatically, because they haven't engaged with that which was there, and the power is broken in you, so it's no longer, it can't affect them. But actually, if they have engaged in it, then they are responsible to repent and renounce that and deal with it, because they've empowered it by agreeing with it. So it depends what's happened in their lives and what stage they are. Obviously, little children, if you have little children, do as much as you can to deal with your DNA, because it will affect them. Aunties and uncles and all that sort of stuff, probably not. Because you're talking about what comes from you in that way. Because they won't carry your ongoing DNA in them. You know, although you will have obviously received DNA from your parents, and you have to look at dealing with the bloodlines and things that they've passed on to you. Some of those are genetic, some of those are epigenetic. But once it's dealt with in you, you can stop it going on to the next generation. All right, okay, well, let's leave it there. Let's re-adjourn sort of 6:30 for 7 o'clock. I think we may be having some music and stuff tonight, so I think, is that 6:30?